We don't really know what a sort of chain reaction would happen if, for example, NATO ASSET was attacked in any way, shape or form, whether it's jamming, spoofing, or whether it's actually kinetically attacked. There's a whole lot of questions that haven't been discussed, and I think that's partly because an attack in space is still entirely unprecedented. It's a red line that we haven't crossed yet. However, I do think we need to have the processes in place to decide what would happen if it did. And specifically, if we're talking in a multilateral setting, to actually reach consensus between the member states before such a thing happens, so that you have the processes in place to act and react once something has actually happened.
Hey, Space Watchers, this is Space Cafe Radio, your channel about trends, awesome events, and interesting people in the space sector. Early March, I attended the DGI 2024 conference in London, the Geospatial Intelligence for Defense and Security Conference. As the name suggests, this conference is focused on defense and security using the geospatial intelligence capabilities from land, air, sea, and space. And space is a rising star in that domain. I would say that Gathering is one of the top-level unclassified conferences that you can find in Europe. During my stay in London, I got the opportunity to meet with Juliana Süß at RUSI in Whitehall. I'm Thorsten, publisher of Spacewatch.global. Enjoy this episode.
Hey, Space Watchers, and welcome to another episode of our Space Cafe Radio. And I'm very excited to have a wonderful guest that I'm meeting in person. And I have the great pleasure to speak with Juliana Süß from RUSI. Juliana, welcome to our Space Cafe Radio.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Tell us what RUSI is. So give us an insight of what RUSI is doing, what your work is, and how does that all relate to space?
First of all, welcome to RUSI. RUSI stands for the Royal United Services Institute, and we are a defense and security think tank. Space falls under the category as well. So while RUSI was founded quite a while ago, we've definitely expanded the notion of what security and defense actually means. So we no longer do just military sciences. We also do financial crime, organized crime, as well as regional studies. So we've got quite a broad sort of span of research that we're doing. I'm part of the military sciences team. My colleagues do land, air and sea, C4ISR as well, and I do space.
I learned over the last days here at the DGI that most of the defense organization is seeing it from seabed to space in the meantime. So that's an interesting term I will try to adopt. Did you say RUSI was founded quite a while ago? That's an understatement. I read the brochure at the entrance that it's the oldest military think tank worldwide.
Yes, so we were founded in 1831 by the Duke of Wellington, and we've been running ever since. So yeah, that, I think, as far as we know, that makes us the oldest defense and security think tank in the world.
What brings a German to a UK think tank?
Excellent question. I actually studied in the UK, and I found out about RUSI, I think it was around my second year of my undergrad degree. And I was like, I didn't realize you could have a job where you just research all day. Obviously, that's the most basic notion of what we do. We do more than just research all day. But I was really fascinated by that notion of being able to do that job. So RUSI was on my radar ever since then. And then I did my master's degree, did a couple of internships, and started at RUSI pretty much straight away.
That's very interesting. We had the great pleasure to publish a number of articles from your predecessor in the space sector from Ali Strickland over the years. So can you tell us a bit about the role of space, how that might have been changed? Is it just one-off, or how dominant is it?
Space within defense and security?
In your work.
Absolutely. I think space has sort of definitely experienced a bit of a renaissance in terms of how it's being perceived in the last couple of years. Obviously, we didn't enter space in 1957 for purely scientific reasons or just for the benefit of mankind.
We didn't?
No. Alas, I wish we had, but space has always been used for military purposes. It's delved into for military reasons. And I think obviously the space race was perhaps a sort of peak of that moment back in the Cold War, and maybe was a little bit forgotten in terms of where the public saw it, or at least dropped from the perception more generally. But space has always been there, and space has always enabled military capabilities. And I think that perception has definitely picked up again over the last couple of years. We've obviously seen space commands being established and created, or niches for space within the military created in a lot of places over the last couple of years. So yeah, that's where I sit. And that's where I try to sort of aid understanding of where space fits into all of this from the military integration point of view, but also in terms of space as a domain, right? Do we see counter space weapons? What's actually happening in space?
And do you have a team you work with on the space side, or is it just you?
In terms of space, in terms of full-time staff, it is just me. Okay. I do have people I could lean on. There's our associate fellows that we speak with, and the general sort of space community that we have in London, but also more widely in Europe. Space community is a very welcoming one, so I've been able to lean on their advice quite often.
What outreach does Roosie do? Do you prepare just for your military clients or for your clients more in general, or security clients, or are you doing a public outreach as well? And if so, how does it look like?
So in terms of our outputs, we've obviously got publications, we've got events, conferences, workshops, roundtables, the whole variety. And actually, I would argue the majority of those are available publicly. There's obviously some paywall stuff on our website in terms of publications as well. Some events will be invitation only, but in general, we're open for members and people who are generally interested at join us. And that's often what makes a discussion so valuable as well.
And you're not just calling when it comes to the space sector, you're also a fellow podcaster.
Yeah.
Tell us more about that. That's part of the outreach, I assume, of the organization.
And I actually forgot to mention podcasts and videos altogether, but we do those as well. Yes, so War in Space is a podcast that I host, and actually it was part of the job. So when I actually applied for this job, it was already part of my job description to be hosting a podcast.
Oh, really? Okay.
So we've been running War in Space for 2.5 years now. We've not had you on yet. The invitation is coming.
Okay.
But we've had a number of fantastic guests already. Obviously, AVM Godfrey, the commander of Space Command here in the UK. We've had Helen Sharman, first British female astronaut. A number of fantastic guests. And it's a really great way to get to know the wider space network. It's a great way to connect with people and get to ask questions. And yeah, we've done 38 episodes now and still running.
Respect. Quite sure that's a big overlap in terms of guests on your lineup as well. Let's switch a bit the direction of the conversation. How does current conflicts change our work and our system of organizing and ruling space? Do you see something? I mean, we have the Outer Space Treaty and space laws or space policies in a number of countries. We have to say that's patchwork still, even among the spacefaring nations. But with the imminent conflicts at the moment, is there a change to see? And I'm not just asking about the nukes in space, but that's obviously something that at the Munich Security Conference that hit the headlines.
Absolutely. If we're looking back to the laws and treaties that we have on space, specifically the 1967 Outer Space Treaty that you mentioned, that is relatively basic in terms of what it says what you can and can't do. In relation to weapons, obviously, weapons of mass destruction are banned from being placed in space, but that's not something that we've seen so far. So in terms of using space for military purposes, as a broad and basic statement, that in itself is not barred or banned through any of the existing laws and treaties that we have.
So is a final militarization of space unavoidable? And yes, you mentioned it before, we're coming from there as the ultimate high ground, but with the UN Charter, with the Outer Space Treaty, with the peaceful use of outer space endeavor, we see this shift now after the period of Cold War now being unfortunately back into a hot war. And we see announcements, call it propaganda, that goes along with that. So is it unavoidable?
So I think it's quite important to also distinguish between the weaponization and the militarization of space. And just for any listeners who are not quite clear on the distinctions, so the militarization of space simply includes using space for military purposes as well as peaceful purposes, which obviously is what we're seeing already in terms of space capabilities enabling certain military functions, GPS, satellite communications, intelligence gathering through optical images, for example, gathered in space. And the other is the weaponization of space, so actually placing weapons in space. I don't think it's inevitable. I don't think anything is inevitable in that sense. I think obviously we have seen, and most recently the news, space nukes, you've already mentioned it. We've seen that certain weapons are being developed that could be placed into space, whether they will or not is obviously a separate question. But yeah, again, I don't think it's inevitable yet, because I think actually, and we're going back to the sort of laws and treaties that we have, obviously there has been criticism of the OST saying that it's so basic in its principles that we need something new. And I do think we need additions to the OST to keep it up to date. But I think actually what makes it so valuable is the fact that it's based on quite basic principles and that there's a very basic consensus, the sort of foundation that was laid back in 1967. And actually something that I think holds to this day is our mutual dependence on space. Everyone is dependent on space to an extent.
And even, it's rising dramatically. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. And I think even states who are not outright space powers are still space users and are still dependent on space. And that is still something that I think acts as a deterrence for kinetic options in space, but also potential nuclear weapons in space. I think that deterrent is still there.
You mentioned the potential additions to the Outer Space Treaty. We have seen a number of activities by UNIDIR, the Disarmament Research Center in Geneva, with the GGE, the group of experts, or PAROS also. And recently now the Open Working Group on Behaviors in Outer Space, your recent guest, Dr. Jessica West, is an avid reporter about it. We had her on a Space Cafe radio episode together with Victoria Sampson. My feeling is that a lot of talks and less outcome, unfortunately. And when can we see this kind of additions? What is your guess? I think you're a think tank. You have this magic ball, the crystal ball.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. We keep it upstairs. I'll show you
on the way out.
I think it's a really tricky one because I think if we're looking at the Open Ended Working Group, and obviously that proposal on responsible behaviors was put forward back in 2020. Mm-hmm. And I think it was quite well received when it first came out. And obviously it was inviting states' responses to it as well. And I think it was so promising for everyone because there was already a lot of momentum being gained. And then obviously we had the Open Ended Working Group sessions. And if you're reading Jessica West's reports, who fantastic reports have saved all of us a lot of time going through the transcripts, you will actually get quite frustrated, specifically if you read the last one, because it seemed that there was consensus being built. It seemed like we were going somewhere. And in the end, obviously, not even a report was passed on to the General Assembly. And there were a couple of states that obviously prevented that from happening. And I think there could have been broad consensus if it had been for certain geopolitical dynamics that sort of prevented this from happening. And specifically, again, reading the report, specifically Russia was very much doubting the process and doubting whether certain actors should be in the room when those things were being discussed, somewhat reminiscent of Cold War tactics in terms of questioning the process and sort of just spending time on discussing process and not actually discussing the content. Because I think there would have been more broad consensus that could have led somewhere. It may not have led to written down complete new treaty that everyone would have signed and that would have been done. But I think it could have led to something a little more productive.
And that's one very small positive takeaway for me from this conversation is that even in a situation of a hot war, that the parties are sitting in one room and talking, not necessarily talking to each other, but at least are talking. And I think there's a bit of hope. But let's focus a bit on our European side here. We have two active hot wars on our European doorsteps, as we all know. But do you think that the European space defense and militaries are prepared for space, for acting in space? We have in parallel here the DGI, the Geospatial Intelligence for Defense and Security Conference going on, and the militaries on the security entities there reporting about the need for space and the role of space, and it's super important. But there's still a lot of demands when it comes to timely information and the amount of data to process AI, you name it. Is Europe ready?
That's an excellent question. I think unpacking it, going through the different sort of needs and where gaps might be. And I think in general, it has to be said that Europe is quite reliant on the United States when it comes to space. Specifically SSA, so Space Situational Awareness. People are feeding into the catalog, but ultimately it's the US that has the most comprehensive SSA catalog that everyone is depending on. And looking at the vehicles that we have as well, the EU, NATO, NATO has published its space approach. Mm-hmm. NATO also called space the fifth operational domain back in 2019, published the approach shortly afterwards, and said quite clearly NATO is not going to buy or have its own sovereign space assets like it did back in the 70s when it had SATCOM satellites. Yeah. It was not going to do that again. This time it's on the member states to put forward the capabilities when and if needed.
Let me jump in here. Does NATO have their own SATCOM capacities?
No.
That's what I thought. So we have the British one, we have the French one, the German ones.
So they did back in the 70s. But so I think actually the department that was in charge of the satellites back in the 70s has now taken over the SATCOM capabilities now in terms of NATO at the center of the allies and pulling together the assets when and as needed. And obviously there's certain sort of things in place. So we know already what countries have put forward the satellite communications capabilities. And there's also a digital constellation called Aquila, which will basically pull together all these ISR capabilities. So in that sense, there is a sort of coherent approach in terms of pulling everything together. But I think there's still quite a few open questions for NATO specifically, especially SSA still very much in the US hands. So as far as I could see, there were plans to have sort of NATO SSA approach as well. How far that has developed, I don't know. But I think SSA is one thing, but I think also the sort of threat assessment is another. And Benjamin Silverstein in the US has written on this quite substantively in the past as well, highlighting.
That's interesting that you say that we haven't been there. And of course, we haven't seen an Assad attack to a foreign nation. We had four Assads, as we all know, but to their own satellites. But coming back to the behaviors in outer space, we had the incidences of getting visited by a Russian satellite, by the Luz satellite and the geo belt. For me, the question is always, how close is too close? And it goes on the same matter of, as you mentioned, SSA, conjunction warning. So when do I have to bring in conjunction warning out or not? With the upcoming satellites, we talk about thousands, tens of thousands of warnings a day at the moment.
It's a really important point, is that SSA or generally tracking satellites can be a very subjective business, right? And we've had instances where a particular satellite company will say, actually, we think we have a collision risk in 12 hours time. Let us call the other satellite company to make sure we can deconflict. And they'll say, oh, for us, on our system, it doesn't come up as a collision risk. So we're not going to move anything. And I think if we're using that scenario, was having a bird's eye view of this from a geopolitical perspective, obviously if that were to happen, if you have a sort of similar situation among states where your satellite was a little bit too close to mine and we think you may have been spying or intercepting communications, for example, I think that's where we come back to responsible behavior.
Yes.
Right? What's too close for comfort? Where do we actually draw the line? And I think responsible behaviors is the right way of going about this, because it's about creating trust and back to you, trust and confidence building measures, which we already did back in 2013, which I think had some some success in building up potential measures. Because I think actually one of the biggest risks that we're potentially walking into is the miscalculation risk.
Mm-hmm.
The misunderstanding of, I don't know where that satellite is going. I don't know if it's getting too close to mine. There's miscalculation element for sure.
What do you think should be done from a think tank point of view to improve our European preparedness for this situation? I mean, we see Odin's Eye as one element brought forward by the European Union for a common strategic element for missile warning and so on. But we're talking about a release in 2028, something like that. All the space systems need time. Yeah, we have Iris Square. I have the feeling that Iris Square is the holy grail at the moment. It's the answer for everything. But what can we do? What have the countries to do?
Yeah, I think in terms of sort of practical gaps that we have, obviously the EU has actually brought forward quite a few big space projects, Copernicus, the Earth Observation Constellation, Galileo, which is the sort of European equivalent to GPS. So we know these big projects can be done. And I think also on a bilateral level, there's a whole lot that can happen. As you say, space is expensive. Space takes time. Space is hard. We hear it all the time, right? So I think collaboration is actually the way to go. And I think this has happened to quite some success already. Obviously, Germany and France are sharing their ISR capabilities. One's providing SAR, so it's synthetic aperture radar. The other's providing the optical element. And then France and Italy, I believe, are also sharing satellite communications capabilities.
Mm-hmm.
So there's definitely room for these kind of arrangements. I think they make sense. I think there's a resilience element here as well, rather than just the sort of cost-sharing element. And I think to an extent, we'll also have to see how much can be done on a multilateral level in terms of the EU level and how much has to be done on a bilateral level. Because there's going to be certain elements that states want to have on a sovereign basis rather than buying into a larger structure. That actually goes back to something that the UK is currently working with. So their sort of structure for procurement or figuring out what space capabilities are needed is OCA, so it's own, collaborate, or access. What can we buy into as a commercial entity? Where can we collaborate with allies? And what do we actually need to own? Mm-hmm. And I think there has been a realization that because space is so expensive and has these long timelines, actually, you should only really own what you need to own. And I think the Americans have understood this probably best because they go with buy what you can, build what you must as a sort of motto for procurement and figuring out what space capabilities you need.
At least among the Five Eyes or Five Eyes plus two, the Americans give the impression that they need the rest of the partners to contribute to a bigger systems. Seeing the budgets and comparing the budgets, might be speaking another language, but they're inviting for international cooperation. My last question, and that's an easy one. Who are the emerging actors that you would advise to keep under observation when it comes to space defense?
Oh, space defense specifically. That's an interesting one. I think actually, going back to Europe, I think France has been talking about how to protect space assets for quite a while. There have been ideas around space bodyguards, so sort of bodyguard satellites that fly around other assets.
Oh, the old angel and demon concept is coming back.
So there's quite a few, I think, emerging space actors that need to be watched if you want to stay up to date on everything. I think in general, sort of space generally actors, I think obviously India, it's been on the scene for quite a while, but I think it was only the private moon mission that sort of really actually brought it to the public sphere. But I think it's definitely made it clear that space is a big priority there as well. And I think also Japan is certainly a space actor to be watched. And also, let's not lose sight of commercial.
Japan just released their new space budget, massively grown. It's a pleasure to speak with Professor Katsuto Suzuki recently about the SLIM mission. And he mentions the improvement of the budget already, the space budget. But now this massive jump is very interesting to see.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think we're at a point now where states are actors also among commercial actors. So definitely also keep an eye out for the new space actors and wherever they are based.
Who are the bad guys?
Who are the bad guys in terms of
space?
In terms of space.
Iran has capacities now. They've proven it, that they could place satellites in space. North Korea, these are the obvious ones. Russia, obviously.
I would go back to who's acting responsibly in space and who isn't acting responsibly in space. I think, obviously, it very much, again, goes back to how much are these plans actually real? How much is this in development? How much do we actually know? But certainly putting a nuclear weapon into space would be a grave irresponsible act.
Yeah.
Also break the Outer Space Treaty of 1967 and also undo a lot of the work that Russia has been doing in space. There have also been some close encounters, obviously, that we've observed by Chinese satellites whose activities we've not really been able to see transparency element there as well.
Mm.
You mentioned Iran and North Korea. I think North Korea is an interesting one because they've obviously just put their first actually successful satellite into space. So it had space launches before two satellites, but they were reported to not be sending signals or tumbling very early on after the launch. So it seems that this is, at least from what we as outsiders can tell, this seems to be the first successful launch. That being said, you don't need to be a space power to be disruptive in space. North Korea, as Iran, have definitely proven that with their electronic warfare capabilities, being able to at least have an effect or disrupt space-enabled capabilities in terms of downlink, jamming and spoofing. But also cyber attacks. I think that's definitely a threat that's flying under the radar. Also, specifically for commercial actors who might say, I've got a civil functions for my space assets. Who would want to hack my system? Or who would hack a satellite? There's been this sort of, oh, it's so obscure. I don't need to worry about protecting my satellite from a cyber perspective. But
didn't that mindset change over the last years?
I think it is changing. I don't think we're yet there where we want to be in terms of awareness of the cyber risk.
Fair point. Juliana, thank you very much for your time and for this wonderful Space Cafe Radio. I hope that's just the beginning and looking forward to more.
Well, thank you very much.
If you have further questions, reach out to us at radio@spacewatch.global. If you like these or other episodes of Space Cafe Radio, leave us a rating on your preferred podcast platform. It is the currency of today. And if you want to stay on the pulse of the space industry, please visit our website at www.spacewatch.global and subscribe to our newsletters. And of course, don't forget to become a Space Watcher. I'm Thorsten Kreening, publisher at spacewatch.global, your independent perspective on space.